Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn and Anne Ball. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
Chinese researchers have developed a robot designed to help doctors treat the new coronavirus and other highly contagious diseases. The machine has a long robotic arm attached to a base with wheels. It can perform some of the same medical examination tasks as doctors. For example, the device can perform ultrasounds, collect fluid samples from a person's mouth, and listen to sounds made by a patient's organs. Cameras record the robot's activities, which are controlled remotely so doctors can avoid coming in close contact with infected patients. Doctors and other medical workers can operate the machine from a nearby room or from much farther away. The robot's main designer is Zheng Gongti, an engineer and professor at China's Tsinghua University in Beijing. He told Reuters news agency that he got the idea for the device around the time of the Lunar New Year in January. At the time, the number of cases of the COVID-19 virus was rising quickly in the city of Wuhan. COVID-19 is the disease caused by the new coronavirus. Zheng said a friend of his is the head of Beijing's Tsinghua Chenggong Hospital. He said his friend told him that one of the biggest problems in dealing with COVID-19 was that healthcare workers treating patients were getting infected themselves. Zheng said he wanted to do something to help this situation. So the engineer gathered a team and went to work on the robotic device. Zheng said the team was able to convert two robotic arms. The devices use the same technology that is used for space equipment, including moon explorers. The new robot is almost completely automated, Zheng said. It can even disinfect itself after performing actions involving patient contact. Doctors are all very brave, Zheng told Reuters. But this virus is just too contagious. We can use robots to perform the most dangerous tasks. However, Zheng said he had heard from some doctors that it would be better not to build such robots to be fully automatic. This is because many patients still desire a personal presence to help calm them during treatment. The team currently has two robots, and both have been tested by doctors at hospitals in Beijing. One machine was taken to Wuhan's Union Hospital, where doctors there were being trained to use it. The plan is to use the robot to help treat coronavirus patients, along with assistance from nurses and other hospital workers. Zheng would like to build more of the robots, but said money from the university has run out. Each robot costs about $72,000 to make. He said he does not plan to commercialize the design but hopes that a company can begin that process. China has sent tens of thousands of medical workers to areas around Wuhan, where the virus first spread widely. More than 3,000 workers had become infected with the COVID-19 virus by late last month. One of them was Dr. Li Wenliang in Wuhan, who died of the virus in early February. Police had accused Li of spreading false information after he voiced concern in December about the fast-spreading sickness. His death led to public sadness and anger at officials over how he had been treated. I'm Brian Lin.
NASA's newest Mars rover is one step closer to being ready to launch next summer. It now has a name. The American Space Agency announced recently that it had named the six-wheeled robotic explorer Perseverance. The rover, which weighs about 1,043 kilograms, will take off for the red planet in July. Its job is to collect samples from Mars for eventual return to Earth. Part of its mission is to look for signs of past microbial life. It will also study the planet's climate and geology. Perseverance is currently going through final building steps and inspection at NASA's Kennedy Space Center in Florida. It is targeted to land at Mars's Jezero crater a little after 3:40 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on February 18th, 2021. Merriam-Webster Learner's Dictionary defines perseverance as the quality that allows someone to continue to do something, even though it is difficult. The name was suggested by 13-year-old Alexander Mather. He took part in the naming contest for American school children. NASA announced the name last Thursday at the boys' school in Burke, Virginia. Mather said, "Humans are explorers, and we will meet many setbacks or problems on the way to Mars. However, we can persevere," he wrote. "We, not as a nation, but as humans, will not give up. The human race will always persevere into the future." NASA's Associate Administrator for Science Missions, Thomas Zurbuchen, said that the space agency's Curiosity rover has been exploring Mars since 2012. Curiosity continues to send data and pictures back to Earth. The qualities of perseverance and curiosity together are what exploration is all about, Zurbuchen said. A plate with the name Perseverance was attached to the rover on March 4th. It serves to block the rover from rocks and debris and protect cables. Mather got the idea for his name from the other rovers that came before it. They have names like Curiosity, Insight, Spirit, and Opportunity. If you think about it, all of these names of past Mars rovers are qualities we possess as humans, he wrote. But if rovers are to be the qualities of us as a race, we missed the most important thing, perseverance. This rover is the latest in a line of Red Planet robotic explorers to be named by school-age children, beginning with Sojourner in 1997. Each one was chosen after a nationwide contest. I'm Anne Ball.
A new study suggests that healthy adults who get at least 8 hours of sleep a night may be less likely to experience common exercise-related injuries. The study was based on information from over 7,500 U.S. soldiers in the Army's Special Operations Forces. About 95% of the study subjects were men. The researchers found that soldiers who got no more than 4 to 5 hours of sleep a night were over 2 times as likely to report bone or muscle injury in the last year than those who slept 8 hours or longer. Tyson Greer is with the U.S. Army Public Health Center in Maryland. He was one of the writers of the study. He said that getting enough sleep not only improves physical performance among active people, but it may also have a positive impact on musculoskeletal injury prevention. During the year-long study, more than half of the soldiers said they had experienced at least one musculoskeletal injury. Most study subjects, about 63%, reported getting 6 to 7 hours of sleep a night. About 10% reported getting no more than 4 hours. Only 16% got 8 hours or more. Compared to those who reported 8 hours of sleep or more each night, soldiers who slept 7 hours were 24% more likely to experience a musculoskeletal injury. The risk climbed as the hours of sleep dropped, with a 53% greater injury risk at 6 hours of sleep. At 5 hours of sleep, the risk of injury was 2 times greater. In the Army, 2/3 of injuries are from musculoskeletal overuse. Most are caused by physical training or repetitive activities, the research team wrote in the study. About 42% of Army soldiers report an average of 5 hours of sleep or less each night. The study notes that making sure soldiers get enough rest could be a way to reduce injury risk. One limitation of the study is that researchers depended on soldiers reporting how long they slept each night. And additional research would be needed to test whether increasing sleep time really reduces injuries. Dr. Ho-Hui Wang is with the University of California, San Francisco. He was not involved in the study. He said that getting too little sleep leads to decreased attention and mental energy, which can lead to people being more likely to get hurt. Wang added that sleep loss causes cell damage in multiple organs. Getting extra sleep might help reverse this cell damage over time. Most people are healthiest and perform their best with 7 to 9 hours of sleep a night, said Captain Jeffrey Osgood. He is with the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research in Maryland. He was not involved in the study. Osgood offered suggestions for how people can get more and better quality sleep. He advises the following. Try to avoid caffeine, nicotine, and exercise in the hours leading up to sleep. Avoid using alcohol as a sleep aid. Don't go to bed hungry. Try to keep your bedroom dark and quiet. Use sleep masks and/or earplugs if needed. And keep your smartphone/devices out of bed.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. Germany's attack on Poland and the start of World War II in Europe presented a problem for Americans in September of 1939. The United States, by law, was neutral, and few Americans had any desire to fight in another world war. But most Americans did not like Germany's Nazi leader, Adolf Hitler. They hoped for victory for Britain, France, and the other Allied powers. President Franklin Delano Roosevelt made this clear in a radio broadcast to Americans soon after the war began.
The overwhelming masses of our people seek peace. Peace at home. And the kind of peace in other lands which will not jeopardize our peace at home. We have certain ideas and certain ideals of national safety, and we must act to preserve that safety today and to preserve the safety of our children in future years. That safety is and will be bound up with the safety of the Western Hemisphere and of the seas adjacent thereto. We seek to keep war from our own firesides by keeping war from coming to the Americas.
He praised the British and other allies. Finally, the president called on Congress to change the neutrality laws that prevented him from sending arms to the Allies to help them fight Germany. Congress agreed to change the laws so foreign nations could buy American arms. In the months that followed, Hitler and his allies claimed one victory after another. German and Soviet troops captured Poland quickly in September of 1939. Then Soviet forces invaded the small Baltic nations of Latvia, Estonia, and Lithuania. In late November, they attacked Finland. Fighting between Finland and the Soviet Union continued through the winter until Finland accepted Russia's demands. Fighting grew even more fierce the following spring in 1940. Germany attacked Denmark and Norway, defeating them easily. In May, German forces struck like lightning through Belgium and Holland. Within one day, they were in France. British and French forces were unable to stop the Germans from moving deep into northern France. The British finally had to flee from the European continent. They sailed back to Britain from the French town of Dunkirk. German soldiers marched through France, and Italian forces joined them by invading France from the south. Soon, Paris fell.
Tage gilt den Verwundeten, die ihr Blut für diesen herrlichen Sieg gaben, der überall an der Front wie in der Heimat.
These are German newsreel narrators describing German troops entering Paris and the fall of the French government. A German supporter, Marshal Pétain, took control of the French government, and France, beaten and crushed, was forced to sign a peace treaty with Hitler. Now it was just Britain alone against Hitler and his Axis allies. Only the English Channel separated the British people from a German army that seemed unbeatable. British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain was forced to resign. The British people turned to a new leader, Winston Churchill.
I speak to you for the first time as Prime Minister in a solemn hour for the life of our country, of our empire, of our allies, and above all, of the cause of freedom. A tremendous battle is raging in France and Flanders. The Germans, by a remarkable combination of air bombing and heavily armored tanks, have broken through the French defenses north of the Maginot Line, and strong columns of their armored vehicles are ravaging the open country, which for the first day or two was without defenders. They have penetrated deeply and spread alarm and confusion in their track.
Churchill would prove to be strong and brave in the long months ahead. The British would need strong leadership. Hitler wasted no time in launching a fierce air attack on Britain. Throughout the summer, German and British planes fought above the English Channel. All of this military action had an important effect on American popular opinion. War and neutrality were no longer just ideas to be discussed and debated. Now they were real concerns, real events. Fascist troops, led by a dictator in Berlin, were defeating one friendly democracy after another, and Soviet forces were on the march, too. Most Americans still wanted neutrality, but how long could America remain at peace? And was peace worth the cost of just sitting by and watching friends like France and Britain being bombed and invaded? Other issues melted away as Americans began to consider what to do about the darkening world situation. Some Americans, led by newspaper publisher William Allen White, called for the United States to help Britain immediately. But other groups, like the America First Committee, demanded that the United States stay out of another bloody European conflict. The struggle between those who wanted to help Britain and those who wanted to remain neutral did not follow traditional party lines. Some of the strongest supporters of Roosevelt's foreign policies were Republicans. Some members of his own Democratic Party opposed his policies. Even so, foreign policy was one of the main issues in the presidential election campaign of 1940. The Democrats once again nominated Franklin Roosevelt for president. The Republicans had several popular candidates who were interested in campaigning against Roosevelt. At first, it seemed that these candidates would fight it out in a bitter nominating convention in Philadelphia. But to everyone's surprise, a little-known candidate named Wendell Willkie suddenly gained a great deal of support and won the nomination.
For the building of an adequate defense, so that no dictator, however strong, may seek to strike, for the unity of our people, for calling again America to its great tradition of progress, I pledge myself to you, and I ask each of you to join with me in this great crusade.
Willkie was a tough candidate. He was friendly, a good businessman, and a strong speaker. He seemed honest, and he seemed to understand foreign policy. Most importantly, Wilkie had a progressive record on many social issues. He was not the kind of traditional conservative Republican that Roosevelt had defeated so easily in his first two campaigns. Instead, Wilkie could claim to represent the average American just as well as Roosevelt, and he offered the excitement of a change in leadership. While Roosevelt and Wilkie began their campaign battles with words, German and British planes were fighting real battles with bullets over the English Channel. Winston Churchill sent a desperate message to Roosevelt. The British Prime Minister said Britain could not fight alone much longer. It needed help immediately. Roosevelt did not want to take steps toward war just before an election, but neither could he refuse such an urgent appeal from the British leader. Roosevelt and Wilkie discussed the situation. Wilkie agreed not to criticize Roosevelt when the president sent 50 ships to the British Navy. He also supported Roosevelt's order for American young men to give their names to Army officials so they could be called up if fighting began. In this way, Roosevelt and Wilkie tried to keep America's growing involvement in the war from becoming a major political issue in the election. President Roosevelt won the election of 1940. He won 27 million votes to 22 million for Wilkie. This made Roosevelt the first and only president in American history to win a third term in the White House. The Constitution was later changed to limit presidents to two terms. Soon after the election, President Roosevelt received a letter from Winston Churchill. The British Prime Minister wrote that Britain urgently needed more arms and planes to fight Germany. Roosevelt agreed. He went to the Congress to plead for more aid to Britain. He said the United States should change its neutral policy because Britain was fighting a common enemy of democracy. Roosevelt also said the United States could avoid war if Britain was strong enough to defeat Germany by itself. Congress agreed, after a fierce debate, to increase aid to Britain. And in the weeks and months that followed, the United States moved closer and closer to open war with Germany. In March of 1941, Roosevelt allowed British ships to come to American ports to be repaired. In June, the United States seized ships under German control. It also took over German and Italian funds in American banks. Open fighting could not be prevented with this increase in tension between Germany and the United States. In September 1941, a German submarine fired at an American ship. The ship was not damaged, but a number of American troops were killed in other naval incidents that followed. By the end of 1941, the United States and Germany were almost at war. Even so, most Americans continued to hope for peace. In fact, few Americans could guess that war was just days away. The first blow would come not from Germany, however, but from Japan.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.